Come on. Hello and welcome to Mind of Mind Hey, the retro game podcast where a couple of out pals get together and talk about a couple of out games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mr. Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we have Mr. Andy Mack.
Good evening, you are.
Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going?
And I've got wee Mr. Smudgy the Rabbit sitting nestled by my feet, as per. Boys, how are yous doing? Just a quick welfare check, first and foremost.
Aye, all right, man. I don't know if this is a game-related thing. we'll probably be here for about an hour or something.
We've got Andy's Wayne, Andy Jr., also joining us in a way.
But when it wants to, your kids are only shy.
Mick, how you doing?
Aye, not too bad. I was slightly late for starting this episode because I was playing a game with my niece on her iPad. Some horrible horror game about an evil baby.
Was it like shovelware type shite? Aye.
It looked like not too bad production values.
Aye.
It's called The Baby in Yellow, which is like a kind of creepy illusion for a game for like 6-year-olds to be playing.
Aye, a kind of has to the King in Yellow type thing.
But exactly, aye.
Mixed with Rugrats.
But yeah, you're like you're a babysitter looking after a wee baby, doing things, changing its nappy and getting a bottle on that, but it's kind of slowly revealed to you that it's a demon.
Very good.
Yeah, I don't know what the Generation Alpha are going to end up like when that's what they're exposed to, but it's probably better than what we were doing.
Better than Chuck Rock.
That's true. Chuggy.
I don't know, Chuggy. Man. I still see you've got all that crazy choices that you end up just looking at a screen, choosing what to pick instead of actually having something to play. I prefer having like 5 or 6 games and I'm like Darth Vader anyway.
Hey, you've got wee AJ there making noises like Zool or something behind you.
I don't think I'm going to. This is going to be a losing battle for me, I think.
He's going to start saying red rum, red rum.
Aye, Wayne's now got too much choice. I sound like an old bleeper, whatever.
You've got Wayne's booing you for saying that in real time.
I know, but there was many I can have. Aye.
Right, I suppose I'll just fly in to the premise of this episode here, right? Remind Andy that he does have a mute button as well, and
right.
I'll kick in explaining what we're doing here. Your movie tie-in games, everybody had them in amongst their kind of wee piles, do you know what I mean? You would have your classics, your Sonics, your Marios, whatever, but everybody's pretty much going to have a random wee Dick Tracy or a Last Action Hero or something along those lines, do you know what I mean? They were a big part of games back in the day, and in a less cynical time, we didn't always automatically assume they were shite, and also, they weren't always automatically shite. A lot of them were pretty good. So, in lieu of getting you a regular Mince and Totties Neddy this week, we've got one of your kind of listicle episodes.
It's usually that way around. It's usually the films that are made by games are usually shite. I can't think of one good one. Maybe Mortal Kombat.
Usually, film adaptations of games are terrible, but I think game tie-ins of films, they don't really happen anymore. We're kind of past them. And before that, we hit a point of extreme saturation where they were seen as just shite, complete lazy cash-ins, developers making the same fucking third-person action game and putting insert character here in it. But back in the day, you would get a wee bit creative with them. And maybe later on as well, you got some creative ones as well. But yes, in lieu of your regular programming this week, because of some scheduling conflicts, we've got a wee listicle episode for yous. But I know some listeners actually prefer listicle episodes as well, so...
Wrongians.
Well, I mean, they're not our favourites, but they are some people's favourites, I guess. But aye, we've got our top 5 movie tie-in games. I don't know about you boys, I will be doing no particular order. The one I read out first doesn't necessarily mean it's the 5th best and vice versa. I'm just giving you 5 that I like.
I've certainly got a list of 5 games, that's for sure.
What do you mean?
I've got ones that... I knew that when Mick and Andy were either off work or hardly working, they would have a head start on me, so I was going to be left with the dregs. But I've got five interesting games anyway.
Mick, I'm going to pick on you then. Please give us your first dreg.
So this actually isn't a dreg, this is a pretty good game. One I had the fond memories of playing on the PS2 in a game which, unusually, the main thing that you would remember about this game is its movement mechanic. This is Spider-Man 2. For the PS2.
Resident Dynamite Neddy, Oracle, Aero. I said to him, what are you saying to it? Movie tie-in games, what's the best one? Spider-Man 2. It didn't take 2 minutes to respond, you know what I mean? Straight in with it.
See, it's funny you went with Spider-Man 2, because if I was choosing, I would go for the old Spider-Man game for the PS1. I thought that was the one that was like faithful to comics and that. It was a good laugh, but it'll be interesting to hear why you've picked this one.
That wasn't a movie tie-in, but aye. Spider-Man 2, anyway.
Well, at the risk of pissing off a few listeners, I don't really care about the comics. So, you got all your kind of favourite spandex-clad villains to face off again in the first one, but what Spider-Man 2 cracked was the feeling of being in the film, of seeing Spider-Man fucking going through New York, fucking firing his spunky web across the skyline. Just kind of zipping from building to building, using momentum.
Mind the girl.
I'm not first person to make this comparison.
No, but like any modern Spider-Man game, the first thing, you put a control pad in somebody's hands, they want to leap off a building and see how slinging about New York City on webs feels. That's the first thing you're doing.
Aye. Well, they were making this game, like, that was one of the things they were kind of disappointed at the adaptation of the first game, was his movement. It was that you basically just... You're launching your web into the air, effectively. It's not attached on anything, and you're just kind of swinging from place to place. It's all a bit kind of... It's not really based in any sort of physics or based in any reality or anything. It's kind of boring. So with this one, they made a lot of effort into making sure that, you know, every time you're firing off a web, it's connecting with something in the world, and you're kind of using that positioning and that momentum to move around. It's just really satisfying to bound around. And there's obviously the other stuff you're doing in the game as well. You're kind of typical Spider-Man sort of fighting small-town criminals and stuff like that and getting into boss battles and stuff. But the main thing you remember is just having New York City open to you. Just, I mean, much like when Spider-Man discovers that he can do what he can do, you know, initially he's a bit scared, he's a bit almost revolted by it, but when he realises the potential... He just goes completely wild with it and has a great time. And you're having a great time when you're inhabiting his shoes in this game.
Aye. And then he tries to spit his sort of secretion digestion liquid on Gina Davis. That's Flyman, isn't it? Dr. Seth Brundle. Andy, I share your thing about that PlayStation 1 Spider-Man game, though. I had that back in the day. And I remember the web spinning and that feeling pretty good. And when you look at it now, he's just shooting webs directly up into the sky. Like, it makes no sense. Like, the entire game is on top of rooftops, but...
Because I remember the Spider-Man 1 game being, like, wee levels. Like, you'd fight all the baddies for the comics and that. But you would be... I think it was more like it was a beat-em-up, wasn't it? Like, a kind of third-person beat-em-up kind of game.
And you had creepy old Stan Lee doing a voiceover in it.
Aye, it was good. That was probably my favourite Spider-Man game. Aye, I really enjoyed that one. These two, I remember it had the wow factor, kind of that GTA effect where you had the open world and instead of driving about, you webbed about, man. But then you realised it was just, as you said, rooftops.
Mick, did Spider-Man 2 have the pizza delivery minigame?
Aye, I think it did, where you have to get across the city in a certain amount of time.
Aye, undefeated,
that's
man.
That's when Spider-Man shines, when you realise he's actually just a teenage boy and he's got to do teenage boy things, like fucking have shitty jobs and that.
Aye. No, it was great fun. Crack our first pick to kick us off, anyway. Mr. Andy Mack, why don't you come in with your number five?
Right, I'll come in with... Is it in order, or is it like any order?
It's up to you.
Right, so I'll go for Star Wars Episode 1.
How many times has this come up?
This game came out pretty recently for the PS5. I ported it, and I always thought it was a game that stood out to me because I loved Star Wars back in the day, man. And this gave you, like, the opportunity to really, like, get your teeth into the Star Wars world. especially if you were skint and only had a Pentium 2 processor and never had a PlayStation 1.
It didn't though. Have you ever played this game? Have you played the first level of this game? Do you remember that famous bit in the film where Obi-Wan is like going through a load of air vents being chased by robots? Remember that bit of the film where he's like stuck in a swamp and he can't get out because of bad collision detection?
But that's the thing, like it's the Star Wars, it's the Star Wars episode 1, but with artistic kind of license to just like go wee tangents, man. I quite enjoy it.
Andy, you have got level 2 of flashback syndrome for this entire game. You don't like this game. You like going to Tatooine and going to the pub and get on that weird wee adventure game bit of this game. That's the main thing for you.
I do. I really do. I've always loved that kind of thing in a game where it just breaks it up in monotony and then you're just walking about talking to cunts.
I like that as well.
It's good, man. And you're trying to find the continuum trunks functioner to get him. you're trying to find out things about the lore and all that. People are shouting, if you want to buy some chokey, remember chokey? Free for a pound, not that.
You were talking about the bold Craig as one of your favourites.
I've not even got to Craig yet, man. Masterful character. You know, characters that turn up and don't really say much, but just kind of can stick with you. Basically, you go to this pub at the arena when you go to a pod race, and you meet this guy who's fucking pissed, and he says he's got parts for you for your continuing transfunctional T27 hard drive or whatever it is. And he says the only way you'll get it is if you buy his mate Craig a drink day. The two heavies come over and throw the steaming guy out. So your mission is to go and find Craig, who is this kind of thing that looks like imagine 4 bits of sellotape kind of stuck up away so that it goes in a curve so that it's defying gravity a wee bit with eyeballs stuck on the front of it.
Is he like the guy in Star Wars where it says a guy's like, we're wanted men, we've got a death sentence on 12 systems, and he's pointing to his pal, it's got this mad bum face. Is Craig one of them aliens?
He doesn't like you, type of thing.
Aye, I don't like you either, we've got a death sentence on 12 systems.
Craig does like you. He's a... the pub's called Athorian, I think. It's called the 7G Lounge. I think he is an Athorian. He's a friend of this guy who's a pure steamer, who's Watto's kind of pal. The guy agrees, basically the steaming agrees to help you on the condition that you buy him a glass of what he calls Jury Juice, which is an alcoholic drink. And he said if you get a Jury Juice from my friend Craig, who's enjoying the performance of Wookiee and Autolone musicians at the time, then he'll get you the parts. And Craig's an interesting looking wee thing. He's an Ithorian.
Got a very strong sense of deja vu here.
And I just think it's a cool wee set piece, and he's probably one of my favourite things about the whole Star Wars universe, never mind the game, and I really like him. There's a lot of good things about this game, by the way. Like, you go down in the water, down to the Gungan facility.
You meet a Jar Jar people.
Jar Jar.
Can you kill them?
You can, yes, and they all go, you hear Live and Learn blast in the background, hold on. Right, so you go down to the Gungans, you've got a choice to make them all kind of hostile against you, but I think it looks really good. Have you ever seen the Gungan level in this game?
I packed it in, like, well before that when we were playing this in the episode.
Really, really cool looking. And you get to fight Jabba the Slut's kind of henchman as well. You've got to fight him, or I think people put bets on you to who's going to win, him or the guy. I see it's his champion, he calls it, or something like that. And if you slaughter them, then you get back to the surface to go to Naboo or something like that. But the game's got its plus points. Plus, it's got a great fight with Darth Maul as well.
Never let it be said that you don't love Episode 1 for the PlayStation/PC. I think if a future civilization discovered this podcast in like their archives, but computer games had been lost, they would probably think that Star Wars Episode 1 was one of the most important games ever made.
But there's There is something I love about this game, man. I mean, Qui-Gon, you go Qui-Gon, you go Obi-Wan, and you even go, what's her name again? Queen Chumbawamba, what's her name?
Queen Amidala.
That's her. You go her too. And her flunky, who turns out to be her, by the way. But I, listen, I've got a lot of fond memories of this game, more than bad memories of this game.
Aye.
Aye, and the whole pod race bit's good too, man. Like, that whole bit in the arena, not just the bit with Craig, which I love, is good. It's a good level.
That's kind of what I was wanting to do with the premise for this one anyway. No, just pick the big crackers that everybody knows about. I'm sure we're going to have GoldenEye representation at some point, but the wee random ones that you had, do you know, there's going to be some dude there who will sit and tell you about how, like, Fifth Element for PlayStation's a pure cracker, but nobody knows about it, do you know what I mean?
Thing is, look, where you love, like, Teletech Simulator, I call it, which is a wee bit deductive, aye, but I find myself enjoying, like, set pieces in games, man. Like, as you said, level 2 flashback, the Toe Jam Nero hot tub level, and this Craig King, certain gaffes and Shenmue, the Hidden Palace and fucking Sonic 3 Knuckles, I don't know why, I'm a fucking weirdo, but here we are. I made it to 35.
Made it to 35, you're having a kind of senile dementia-esque reverie here.
Here, son, let me tell you about Craig. Mr. MacArthur, come on, sit down, take your medicine. He's in the 7G lounge and he had to get parts for your pod racer, son. Craig was the boy's name, so it was.
Where's them dominoes?
I'm going to come in with my number five here. I'm going to kick yous off with something that wasn't from my wee pile, but that I played later during my kind of emulation phase. It's for 1989, and it is a Zelda clone for the original Nintendo, and it is Willow.
Fud.
No, not genius Irish football player Willow Flood. This is the Warwick Davis character from the George Lucas movie. This is a nice wee Capcom, as I say, Zelda clone. You've got a top-down adventure game where we play as Willow as he basically traverses the events of the film. The film is about this band of characters, a kind of loose fellowship, you might call it, if you wanted to say that they're ripping off Tolkien. But they go on this whole adventure across a fantasy land, gather allies and such. In the video game, you're just Willow on his Todd, because it's not a traditional RPG, I guess. They went for a Zelda type one, as I say. And you pick up equipment, you gain levels, you learn different magic spells, all that kind of good stuff. It does rip off quite a lot from the original Legend of Zelda, but you know what? This is kind of what makes it good.
And it seems like a kind of good fit for that sort of genre as well.
You're yeah.
Kicking about as the wee guy is not really known for his strength, but more his ingenuity and his intelligence and that. So he's not really a fighter, but he's still probably solving puzzles and the like, I guess.
Oh, good exciting stuff.
Aye. And again, I think this game's a wee bit of a hidden gem. And I think the film's a bit underrated as well. I've always been a big fan of the movie.
I tried to watch it quite recently, and I didn't grow up with it, and it wasn't grabbing me, to be honest, but I think I'm possibly past it, and old and jaded.
That's interesting, Mick. I didn't realise this was a nostalgia goggles one for me.
Could be. Give it to your memories. A similar film that I do think holds up very well is Labyrinth, though. That's still great.
I like Labyrinth a lot. I'm more a Labyrinth fan than a Dark Crystal fan. I know that's sacrilege to some people.
No, the Dark Crystal puppets weird me out too much.
You don't get the level of crotch shots in Willow that you do in Labyrinth, do you know what I mean? Fucking Val Kilmer ain't packing what Boy was packing. Willow, good wee game. I will jump in and give you my number four as well, right? Because I know sometimes I get us doing them back to back for flow reasons. My number four, and again I'm doing these in no particular order, is 1996 PS1/Sega Saturn/DOS classic Alien Trilogy.
That's a good one.
It's one of the ones that I like to look back at to sort of measure, like, graphical progress in video games, because I remember getting this for Christmas a wee bit later than 1996. I don't think any cunt in Greenock had a PlayStation in 1996 unless they were like the richest people in town.
What year was it we started getting them? Was it 96, 98 maybe?
I think I got a PlayStation in the year 2000. Maybe, or possibly 1999. Aye, so I like to use Alien Trilogy as a wee bit of a milestone for like graphical progress in games, because at the time it looked so impressive and new, it really Disney. It looks a pure pixely mess, do you know what I mean?
Is this, I don't know this one at all, to be honest. Is that the one that's kind of like first person shooter?
Yes, it's
I used to get this one mixed up with Die Hard Trilogy, not in terms of games, but in terms of types of games. I always thought that this game was split up into three as well in my head canon for some reason, but it's not. It's just a one game called Alien Trilogy, innit?
It's split up into three, right? But you're supposed to be playing through Alien, Aliens and Alien 3, but really you're just playing through Aliens three times. Like, the Alien part is nothing like Alien, and the Alien 3 part is nothing like Alien 3. The whole game is just Aliens.
So a wee bit Quake in it, kind of?
Yes, very much so. It's what we were talking about last episode. It's a boomer shooter. You're kicking about with these kind of tank controls, picking up different sorts of weapons, and just fucking blasting xenomorphs, man. Going through creepy big bases that have been taken over by the alien scum, and fucking doing them in, picking up lots of different weapons. Some of the iconic ones for the movie, you do get a flamethrower and stuff like that. The killer app in this shin, right, I'll tell you, was your different enemy types. You had the facehuggers. Remember the facehuggers for the movies?
Aye.
So the facehuggers would crawl about, and if you didn't kill them quickly enough, they would crawl up you. And then they would be, like, on the whole screen, like, face-hugging the screen.
Aye.
As if they were on your actual face. Like, so that was great. A class wee bit of, like, FPS horror.
Is that like Hussie Deed when they fucking get too close and then they, like, start eating the camera and that?
Aye. Chaos all around about you and there's aliens everywhere and then you get a face-hugger. It starts, panic pure starts setting in, you're blind firing and all that.
Game's a bogey at that point. You're already Deed, man, when a face-hugger's on you. You're already Aye. Deed. That's you.
Effective first-person horror. It was good and atmospheric as well. I have been toying with getting it on the podcast at some point.
Does this game suffer for it? Duke Nukem and Doom, and to a certain extent, Quake suffers by get a key card to move to part B, get a key card to move to part C.
If you don't like that, let me tell you, this isn't for you. Because there's a lot of getting key cards. the only gameplay loop in this is basically opening up different doors and killing aliens. There's really not much else to it. So it's more about the atmosphere, and it's outdated, right? It's an antiquated gameplay loop, for want of a better term. But I've probably got the nostalgia goggles for it, and I just enjoy it. Speaking of alien games, which I think it tends to be the case that these are ones that have got better over the years. Like, it's a film franchise. Well, unfortunately, it's a franchise, but it's that they're films that, for whatever reason, sort of lend themselves well to, like, a video game programmer's imagination quite well, maybe because of the science fiction angle. I've been choking to play that Alien Isolation.
That's fucking brilliant, mate, to be, man.
Right. It's just you and a xenomorph, and you've got no weapons, and the whole game's about fucking hiding for it, like controlling your breathing and all of that while it stalks a ship and fucking kills everybody. To me, that sounds like the perfect alien game.
This game's kind of dark as well, isn't it? Like Fog of War, kind of. Things jumping out at the last minute at you.
Makes sense though, you're in a wee claustrophobic like spaceship or space station or something. Loads of pipes and vents and stuff. It does suit itself very well to a game, especially like one of these early FPSs or early sort of survival horror games.
Well, Alien 1 was all about that kind of claustrophobia, wasn't it? But stuck on this wee tin can with a fucking big alien. And kind of obviously brought up forward to the game, which is what all you're asking for, isn't it?
I think of first-person shooters of the era, this is probably a pretty good one. You're not going to hear anybody say it's one of the best, you know, it's not a fucking Quake 2 or anything like that, but...
I'll tell you the one often they hear cited sometimes as the best first-person shooter of all time, Alien vs. Predator.
Yeah, I was actually talking to McMenemy about some of my picks before this, and he was touting the AVP games which I've no really got any familiarity with. I've never played an Alien vs Predator.
Aye, often cited as one of the best, aye, right up there. The other one it's cited as System Shock 2 for like horror first person shooters, I mean.
Aye, I have played that, that's very good.
Don't watch the film.
I didn't know there was a film.
Alien vs Predator?
Oh, Alien vs Predator. That came much later, Alien vs Predator, than the game then.
Aye, because it was always, there were comics first. But yeah, I think there was two Alien vs Predator films, utter gash.
Well, you're talking about System Shock 2, is that not kind of remade as Bioshock? The game Bioshock for the Xbox?
It was made by the same folk, or some of the same team.
Spiritual successor, you could say, maybe. But anyway, that'll do us for Alien Trilogy, I think.
We're about to go on a pure tangent about horror shooters there.
I could feel it coming. I thought I'd fucking clamp that. Right, Mr. Horror Shooter, why don't you come in and engage your number four then?
Big hitter then. Let's go for a big hitter. Right, I'm going to go for a game based on... It's a weird thing, it's a weird situation. It's a game based on a film that isn't really based on a film, but it kind of is to kind of trap an American audience. This game is called Dynamite Decca for the Sega Titan video arcade machine. But its name was changed in the PAL region to Die Hard Arcade for some weird reason, despite it not featuring anybody for Die Hard, except on the case where John McClane looks more like Paul Burrell, Diana's butler, than fucking Bruce Willis.
Do they not mess about with any of the assets then? Do they not change the guy's sprite to look like John McClane in the game even?
I think what they've possibly done is change his jacket into like a Polish jacket or something like that, but it was right, like right. a bright blue thing. And he's basically... It doesn't look anything like fucking John McClane. And there's a lassie too. Like, who's a lassie? They're not in Nakatomi Plaza. They're in... basically, the conceit of the game is classic, like... Sega EM1 or EM2 arcade plot. A terrorist has taken over a base. He stole the president's daughter, and you've just got to go and get him, and that's it. It's just that there's no linkages to the Die Hard storyline. There's no fucking Severus Snape. There's no fucking mad kind of quips for the main character. There's no like, blood and gore or anything like that. There's nothing.
No, but to pick this game up. Right back, was it Saturn Dreamcast?
This is a Saturn. Well, aye, it's technically arcade, but Saturn, aye.
Saturn. So you're picking this game up for a Saturn. You're in Blockbusters or whatever. You would be under the impression that you were about to take home a game that was Die Hard.
Yeah, that's right. Well, EM2, Sega EM2 or EM1, it might have been at this time. And Sega Technical Institute, ran by Mr. Yu Suzuki at the time, who wanted to create Shenmue, wanted to create a successor to Streets of Rage series. So everything was in 3D at the time. So they said, well, we'll need to make a 3D Streets of Rage then, won't we? And this was the result. And it pulls it off pretty well. Basically, Streets of Rage in 3D. It's got all the crazy stuff where you can use all the weapons, you can use guns as projectiles that aren't deadly, they just sort of knock you on your arse. Big poles, the same as Streets of Rage. Interesting baddies that come in hordes that are all the same with different colours of clays on. Streets of Rage in 3D, man.
Aye.
But the thing about this game is you can see sort of where AM2 wanted to take this type of game, and that they added wee things on, like quick time events. So after every level, you would have to do a quick time event. So we're exploring different avenues of how to sort of create a fighting game. And obviously, the fighting QTE fusion kind of paved the way for the Virtua Fighter RPG, which later became Shenmue as well.
So if Virtua Fighter is Shenmue's da, is Die Hard Arcade Shenmue's more?
Possibly, I think that's a good analogy, aye. Fighting system is more Streets of Rage than Virtua Fighter, aye. But in terms of the scope of what they were trying to do, like that 70-man battle end of Shenmue could be right out of Dynamite Decca, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Die Hard Arcade. But the game's got a lineage right up to games on the Dreamcast. Dynamite Decca 3, also known as Dynamite Cop, in the PAL region, was a success at this game. And I see art as a kind of Streets of Rage game, an extended Streets of Rage.
I've heard you talk about this game many a times. It's probably been brought up in the podcast a good few times before as well. What is your experience with this? Where did you pick this up for? When did you first get a shot at it?
So, there was a guy called that used to stay across the landing for me. You can bleep that out.
Okay.
He had a dream. He had a... You might remember this, McCormick, I don't know, but he had a Saturn. And he used to get his Saturn demo discs. It was like Saturn Force or something it was called. There was a sweet tune on it. And Die Hard Arcade was one of the demos on it, aye. And it was one you could play two-player on, which was a big thing at the time. And you just found yourself kicking fuck out everybody on this first level. Very difficult game. Once you get about the third level, you only get... It's like Streets of Rage, where you only get a certain amount of lives. So it's quite difficult to kind of make a dent in the game. But for what it is, it's brilliant. I mean, you can feel a crunch when you're hitting folk and all that sort of stuff. And I dare say, it's not just Shenmue that this game inspired. It probably inspired Yakuza more. In that the fighting system is based on the Streets of Rage philosophy of fighting, like the Yakuza series was up until the latest games, obviously, that became turn-based. So
aye.
It's a game that would be interesting for somebody that's maybe interested in Streets of Rage, Yakuza, Shenmue. You know, it's quite a significant wee title. I love it, man. I think it's brilliant. It's one I always go back to. You're not going to have a bad time with Die Hard Arcade, Dynamite Decker. And maybe we'll get Dynamite Cop on the show at one point.
Mr. McCormick, do you want to come in with your number four?
Aye, so I'm going to come in with a franchise that's had a lot of different interpretations and adaptations over the years. But this is one that you might not have heard of. It's a Jurassic Park adaptation, and it's called Chaos Island, The Lost World. So this one came out on the PC, or at least it was the PC that I played it on. And unusually for the series, you've probably played quite a few Jurassic Park games. I know there was a lot of platformers and various other things in the Mega Drive era. But this one's like a real-time strategy game based off The Lost World, which I remember not being very good. Don't know if you would agree with me.
We went to see Art of Pictures together, didn't we?
Aye.
Best thing about The Lost World Jurassic Park was the fucking ice lolly. You remember that bad boy?
I might remember, what was it?
It was a green dinosaur head, a green Tyrannosaurus Rex head. Came in a green packet, and it had this kind of purple gel in the middle.
I don't remember that. I can actually taste it, as just describing it right now. It was just a very vivid sense memory I got there.
Top notch.
The Lost World, is that the sequel that they got Jeff Goldblum back for?
Yeah, not Sam Neill.
There's like dinosaur poachers or something.
Aye, they go to an island, and I think, if I remember right, like, there was the main island where the park was, and then there was like a secondary island, which is more dinosaurs sort of living just in their, like, more like their own environment, like more kind of natural, and then dinosaur poachers ended up there, and Jeff Goldblum's heading over to stop them, and then one thing leads to another, and a dinosaur ends up making its way back to civilization, causing havoc. It escapes via boat, I think.
We've got Jurassic Park obsessed pals who would have been shouting the names of the island at you there while listening to this. Anyway, sorry, go on.
So this one is it's like a real-time strategy game, really. So you're controlling people with like a top-down view. You're controlling the various kind of party that's on this island. Jeff Goldblum, Julianne Moore and such. Vince Vaughn's there as well. So what you're doing is kind of trying to stop these poachers, basically. But how you're doing that is that you can build bases and shelters and things as you would in an RTS game. But the main thing you're trying to do is to find dinosaur eggs and take them back to your base and incubate them. And once you incubate them and hatch them, those dinosaurs become friendly and they become like kind of your units that you can command to go and do things for you, or go and attack enemies for you and stuff like that. So I don't know if that's like thematically very appropriate for Jurassic Park, but you're basically training an army of friendly dinosaurs to fucking cause havoc on a load of poachers.
It's fucking nonsense, but also it's quite a good concept for a game, actually.
Yeah, I was playing this game with my cousin Christopher, who had it on the PC, and we never knew anything about it. I think this is possibly like in one of these copied Barris discs where you get a whole load of things, maybe not the game that you kind of you were wanting, but you played it because it was there. you're playing this kind of RTS game and going, I don't know about this, like, I don't know if this really makes much sense. And then you found out about three levels in that you can get dinosaurs on side with you, and like, right, suddenly we're on board. Like,
aye, game changer.
This is brilliant. I do have a memory of like what some of the earlier levels were. There's like a couple of different objectives, but in one you've got a day like simultaneously, and one of them is to release a T-Rex, and then the other one is to like stop incapacitate or kill all the poachers. But we made the mistake of releasing the T-Rex first, who like ends up stalking you throughout the entire level, trying to kill you while you're doing all the other stuff, rather than doing that at the very end. You know, I remember having some tense times.
Easy mistake to make.
Aye, trying to avoid the T-Rex before we could summon a load of fucking velociraptors to take them down.
What's your favourite Jurassic Park dinosaur?
I mean, I'm going to get a few folk absolutely raging at me here because I don't know any of the fucking names anymore. I used to when I was 6 years old, but I'm afraid I don't anymore. But yeah, definitely the spitting ones that didn't exist in actual.
Dilophosaurus is by far my favourite. They didn't have frills. They didn't spit venom, unfortunately. But they menaced Newman for Seinfeld. They fucked him up. They spat at him. Bullied him, basically. Like,
he deserved it.
Pulled him out his motor.
I always find it difficult to decide between my beloved Stegosaurus and my Triceratops, but I do hold a torch for the old Dick Lidocus, man, because he ran before time films.
You're a gentle, peace-loving dinosaur fan then, Andy?
Aye, I like the ones with the stubs for teeth, man,
aye.
Triceratops, mind you. Triceratops can go a few rounds with you, man, if you're not careful.
Triceratops will not start a fight, but it will finish one.
I don't know. Have you seen Land Before Time 3? I don't know about that.
Is this what you've got the wee man watching? Are you taking him through a Land Before Time canon?
Well, he's not got attention span yet, but he will soon.
He'll be a teenager by the time he gets through the Land Before Times.
Aye, I know. Many of them is a new man. There must be about 40 now.
So yeah, for the dinosaur fans, I've got to explain this game a bit further now that I've got the Wikipedia article up. So the dinosaurs available to you are Parasaurolophus, Compsognathus, Pachycephalosaurus, Dilophosaurus, Stegosaurus, Velociraptor, Triceratops, and Tyrannosaurus. They all get access to all those ones. And they also behave differently as well. How herbivores and carnivores kind of behave differently. Herbivores are initially hostile to you. Carnivores will fuck your shit up if you encounter them in the wild.
See, the thing that always gets me is dinosaur, right, is Latin for terrible lizard, right? But they're not lizards. They're birds. What's going on? Are birds technically lizards, mind you? No, birds are reptiles.
No. Common ancestor.
It's a common ancestor thing, aye.
Because birds are technically dinosaurs, because when people go, dinosaurs are extinct, I like to go, well, actually, see that wee pigeon over there? It's a dinosaur.
But they are extinct, because they're not there anymore. Like, they might have not all disappeared, and some of them went on to form other creatures, but dinosaurs no longer exist.
They'll always live on in my heart, bro.
There's an island full of Komodo dragons, which is like as close to Jurassic Park as you can probably get, and it's mere dangerous. Fuck they things, man. Why do we allow them to exist?
What is the closest living thing we've got? A dinosaur, like, genetically?
Komodo dragon, man.
Seagull? Or a Komodo dragon?
They shite poisonous pellets at their mouth. Horrible. They're quick enough to catch up with you and eat you and kill you and shred you to bits with their claws. This is a PSA. We are anti-Komodo dragon on this podcast. Fuck them. They are dangerous menaces.
You think they're the ones you want to get extinct first rather than the old Dick Lidocus, don't you?
Exactly. I don't know why they haven't got people on that, actually, just killing them all.
Mick read a children's encyclopedia at a young age and the article about Komodo dragons for the rest of his life.
Right, Mick, why don't you come in and engage your number three as well?
So I'm going to give you an arcade classic, which is Terminator 2, the arcade game.
Aye, do you know, I was actually expecting T2 Arcade on Andy's list. I feel like I hear him talking about that quite a lot.
This game hones in on a very small part of Terminator 2, but a part that like kind of really stuck with me. The sort of intro, basically, before the Terminator gets fucked back through time, and it's like the, you know, Skynet has risen up and Judgment Day's happened, and these kind of giant skeletal robots are taking over this barren, scorched earth. Like, that's the part that this game really nails.
I liked the bit where you shoot and things fly off it, so now in the Terminator, when you shoot them, bits of his flesh will burn off and it will, like, expose parts of him. You can do that in this game, so you can shoot, like, his skin, you can see a thing underneath, you can shoot bits of metal off and all that. But the thing that really gets me about this game is, it's a light gun game, right? Can you use this, a light gun with this game, or is it only a pad? I've always wondered that.
You mean the Mega Drive port?
The Mega Drive port, aye.
I don't know if the ports of it were any great shakes. I tend to just think of this as an arcade experience where the big skeletal fucking Terminators with the glowing red eyes looked cracker. It was a feast for the senses, man. This was a great play in the arcade.
You've got a giant sort of digitised version of Robert Patrick trying to entice you to play the game and fucking defeat him. That's the attract screen. Because they've got it in that NQ64 and he's always taunting me when I'm having a drink.
Aye. Arnie's still a baddie in that one, isn't he?
No.
Arnie's still a baddie in this game, I mean. Because it's a preview in it. It's like a...
Well, it's his model of Terminator, some of the enemies. This game's got, like, digitised sort of Mortal Kombat-style graphics as well. So it's, like, actual photos and animations of people make up the enemies, which is interesting.
That Robert Patrick attract screen just sounds so sinister. It would probably get me to put like a pound into it as well, because I'd want to beat him so badly.
Sinister looking guy. Seems like a nice fella in real life. It's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, he never ever recovered for selling his fucking sports business to Tony Soprano, did he? He never really got seen again after that.
Dave Scatino. It's hard to take him as seriously after you've seen him at his lowest ebb in the Soprano.
I know. I just heard a stutter step.
Loads of kind of cool set pieces in that. You're gunning down loads of robots. There's a bit where you've got to, like, defend a truck, which is like, there's like helicopters and that flying towards it, and you've got to shoot them away and stuff like that. It's very kind of cinematic, despite just really being a light gun game. But it's a bit of a spectacle.
The interesting thing about setting a video game during the actual War of the Machines is that, according to the lore of the movies, that is an unwinnable war,
yeah,
where humanity will almost certainly be wiped out.
I think actually later levels you do end up going back in time, but obviously it's an arcade game, you're never going to fucking get that far.
No, I can only think of the first fucking section, man, where it's the apocalyptic hellscape you were talking about. I can picture that in my head.
Yeah. Not enough 50p's to get yourself through those.
I'll come in and I'll give you my number three. Right, this is a game... Admittedly, it's probably not a great game, right? This is Rocky for the Xbox/PS2/GameCube.
I like that one. I like that one.
But back when multi-platform releases were just bog standard, every game basically had one, unless it was first party, I had a weird wee liking for this one. It's an arcadey boxing game, right? It's less on the sports sim side and more on the kind of button mashy side, which is perfect for Rocky because it's not an accurate simulation of boxing. When you watch the movies, they don't block, they just punch fuck out each other. It's great. But yeah, the story mode takes you through the events of each Rocky movie in sort of five big arcs, so you'll maybe fight 10 lesser boxers and they'll lead up to a fight with Apollo Creed, which is the big finale of Rocky 1. Then you've got that with Clubber Lang, Ivan Drago, etc. as well. There was a mad wee RPG element where between fights, Rocky had stats that you could increase.
Aye, that was good, that.
You played these wee minigames, so if you played the speed bag and you did really good at the speed bag minigame, you get your speed stat up quite a lot. Or if you did the sit-up minigame, Rocky get more health and things like that.
Is his mental health one of the stats in it? Or like his relationship with his family and that? Because those are always quite important things he's got to balance.
They don't make a minigame out of it, but he does get a dog and like marry Adrian and stuff like that. I'm sure that's... But another wee thing I liked about this was that in the training minigames, they changed the trainer depending on what part of the Rocky chronology that you were in. So if you were in Rocky 1, it would be Mick going, come on, you bum, come on, give me an extra 10 rounds, yeah, or this part. But if you were playing Rocky 3, and it was after Mick was dead, it would be Apollo Creed going, come on, Stallion, come on, give me extra. And then if you played the Rocky 4 ones, it was Apollo Creed's trainer, because in Rocky IV they killed Apollo Creed and then realised that they didn't have anybody to train Rocky anymore. So the guy that trained Apollo just trains him in Russia. But aye, you had some fun wee unlockables in this as well. You could unlock Mickey and the Rocky statue from the top of those stairs in Philly. It was just a decent wee game, man. I'm no huge on boxing games, but I had a lot of fun with this one.
You can tell what kind of some care has been taken to, like, you know, you can tell that the folk that loved the films were involved in the game and kind of took on elements that they just wee details they loved for the films.
Aye, they were definitely fans that made this. Like, the, you know, the opening shot of Rocky 1 is him fighting this absolute duffer called Spider Rico, and the intro to the game recreates that opening shot of Rocky fighting Spider Rico. It's good stuff. So aye, that was Rocky, a game probably better than it had to be, and I just enjoyed it. Andy, do you want to come in and gaze your number three, please?
Aye, okay, so okay, we'll just come in with a normal one. One we've done pretty recently, we'll go with Toy Story.
Oh, the old Mega Drive Toy Story.
Aye, the old Mega Drive one. Basically, I got this quite late in my journey with my Mega Drive, as I said in the last, I think it was the last episode we've done this, wasn't it? Recently, aye. Anyway. And what I found great about it was just how it looked. It didn't look like a Mega Drive game, it looked amazing. But it also was very cool to play a Toy Story game back in 1985 because it was huge. It was fucking huge, man. And the only downside of the whole game was that you couldn't play against Buzz. But you could. So you couldn't play as Buzz, but you could play against him. And you had that fight against them, Nightmare Buzz, which was probably the highlight of the game for me. You had the wee quirks too, like the driving bit, the flying bit, it had bits in Sid's house and all that. It was quite interesting, I quite liked it.
So, we have covered this game very recently. Just, why don't you talk more about, did you have this, or was it a rented Bad Boy, or...?
For some reason I had it, I don't know. I don't know how I got it, but I had the cartridge.
I'm not saying that you couldn't have afforded Toy Story.
No, I had this. I got this game and the Avengers game at the same time. I can remember that. I don't know where for, but I had it. I don't know, man. I think I had a Tamagotchi at the same time as well. Just all these fucking memories coming back, man, but...
It's a good year.
I do remember using the level skip cheat a lot in this game to get the final level. Where you would go Buzz, but it was the closest thing you get to go Buzz when you're attached to a rocket.
And you're a cheater.
Yeah, I'm a cheater, that's right, AJ.
That's it, AJ, get him tilt.
And I would go to the last level where I would could fly about as Buzz and just go Buzz for that brief moment. We all wanted to go Buzz, didn't we? We all wanted to be Buzz.
Some Buzz.
Why don't you come in and engage your number two as well?
Right, okay, so I had a wee think about number two. I'll go with... Do you know what, did I save a big hitter for number one, or did I just go straight, okay, let's do this one. So, this is a wee G4 special that I've not had on the podcast before, PC game. You remember the film The Blair Witch Project?
Yes.
1989, it was a sort of, kind of, it was the first found footage film that became kind of huge. And
it came out when we were in P7, and my enduring memory of it at the time was that as children, it was real. We thought this was a real thing.
Well, it was kind of inspired by... You remember there was a programme in the 90s on BBC with the guy done Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Chris Tarrant.
And another lassie, Sarah Green, maybe. And it was called Ghostwatch. And it was presented as a real documentary, kind of like Most Haunted, where they were going to find ghosts and all that. But it was scripted. And it wasn't announced to the public that it was scripted. And it was presented as live, like with a telephone number and all that, because a phone and you can see anything. And there was a wee lassie getting possessed on it and all that. There was ghosts and it frightened the public to death.
There was a disabled person that topped themselves, man. They weren't able to show that on telly for fucking decades.
Aye. But what it done was, it created this kind of, what do you call it? Norfolk devil, a kind of moral panic. You should be really informing the public and that, it's not real, because you're really fucking terrified as out of death, because at the time we didn't have an internet to tell us no, it wasn't it. So everybody just assumed it was real, but Blair Witch Project kind of took us to the next level, because they put on a documentary in the weeks leading up to the film's release. A documentary was presented as a a factual documentary about this witch that existed in the forest of a fictional American town, complete with lore about serial killers and all that, and people that had been inspired by the witch to go and kill children and all that stuff. I'm terrified of Wayne, I think.
The thing with that Ghostwatch series, and then also this, is something that you can't really get in the era of the internet, in the era where there's basically, like, there's not really, like, really authoritative sources, like the BBC, for example. Folk would watch the BBC back in the day, and that was where you got all your news, and that's where you got, like, you know, you expected, you know, factual representations of things. It's like the authoritative voice of the British state and that. So something comes out of there, you think, well, they can't be lying to us, it's the BBC.
Aye.
Like, for now, you know, we've got the internet, we've got a million different, like, sides to every story, we've got misinformation and disinformation coming from different places, like, everyone's media diet is very fractured. So I think something like the Blair Witch, you know, came out at a time when you might have, you know, you wouldn't have conceived of, like, the filmmakers playing a trick on you in the same way as they can now.
So, Blair Witch project, the film, was, I thought it was a bit of a masterful thing, because it created this lore before the film came out. It created its universe through this documentary, through promos on the telly. And all the film actually was this just amateur kind of art school kind of camcorder thing.
Do you know also, this had that Exorcist effect. I'm sure cunts said that people watched this and died and things like that. Do you not remember that?
Aye. But the film didn't expose anything really, apart from it at start when it showed a wee bit of documentary. The film just showed, like, weird things happening to them in the forest and all that, and then it culminated in, like, the lore coming to life, essentially. But, well, I'm kind of getting off tangent, but this game kind of deals with some of the lore involved in the Blair Witch Project universe, so to speak. This game is a survival horror game. It deals with one of the key figures of the Blair Witch lore, a guy called Rustin Parr, who is a serial killer in the universe.
Is it first person? Are you kicking about with a camcorder?
No, it's... I don't know if you've ever heard of a game called Nocturne.
Yes.
Right, so it uses the same engine as Nocturne, so it's a pre-rendered survival horror game. Aye, a bit like Alone in the Dark, a wee bit.
Aye.
Same idea, aye. But this game is about a... It's basically Rustin Parr was a guy who was a serial killer. He killed seven youngsters because they said that a Blair Witch was talking to him and appearing to him in his dreams, and he couldn't fight against it. And what he would do is he self-exiled himself into the moors of Burkittsville, which is a fictional town in America, and lived in a wee kind of Evil Dead style shack. And what he would do is he would take them down to the basement and kill them one by one, but he would leave one person to witness it so that he could send them back to the town so that they could say, like, Blair Witch done this type of thing. So eventually he got caught and he was given an electric chair. But this is the story where the whole kind of legend comes from. And the game deals with a detective going to a town to find out what actually happened and what the hell made him want to go and kill all them people. Was it because he just self-exiled himself into the woods and became a bit doolally? Or was it actually a supernatural force driving him to commit these horrible crimes?
Is this a detective game? Are you kicking about looking for clues and things?
So
it's no, you're no blasting ghosts and things then?
There's a bit of Twin Peaks about it, where you go from place to place, you get a bit of dialogue about the Faetun members, you trek yourself into a hotel, the hotel says, these are the people you've got to talk to, you go about, they give you a wee bit of lore, oh yes, I knew Rustin Parr very well, he's blah blah blah, done this and done that, maybe you should go and speak to this guy and he'll help you out. But when you're walking through, sometimes you get hostile people who think you're in town to kind of bring up the witch when she should be laid dormant. So you've got to fight them off you. Aye.
That sounds quite good.
That's pretty good, man. It's, as I said, it's based on quite a well-known game from 1989 called Nocturne, which is a survival horror game. Very much of the old guy Alone in the Dark. And these games are forgotten. I think part of the reason they're forgotten is they were made with quite a low budget. And after the sort of kind of zeitgeist of... Zeitgeist kind of passed by the first Blair Witch Project film, the sequels and the media that came after, once it was kind of exposed that it was fake, didn't really set it here. Like, people weren't really as interested in it anymore when they realised it wasn't real.
Aye.
They kind of expand upon a universe when it's meant to be in our universe. You know what I mean?
Aye. But I think that's why it kind of failed. It had two sequels after this as well. Used the same engine. This was the best one. Best story. If you're into it, I mean, you're going to get... I mean, Blair Witch Project's good to kind of go back and look at as a kind of snapshot in time.
Aye.
And if you're wanting to look for a bit of lore, this has got it all. So it's quite an interesting piece. Aye, it's quite enjoy this one.
Blair Witch Project, Rustin Parr.
Aye, it's a win.
McCormick, you want to come in and give your number two?
So I'm going to go for an adaptation. It's a wee bit more modern. This is the video game of Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Ah, it's narrowly missed out in my own list. I thought you'd be going for this one.
Aye. So what this is if you've seen the film, you know that Scott has to defeat 7 evil exes using very kind of video game inspired sort of fights. So this game is basically just takes that very literally, and it's a beat 'em up. Specifically, it's very much like River City Ransom, which we covered a good few episodes ago, where there's kind of slight RPG elements. You're kind of doing sort of Streets of Rage style beat 'em up things, but you're also buying progression, buying extra lives, buying things to upgrade your stats, new moves and that sort of thing. So there's a bit of an additional depth to it as well. It was kind of a who's who of like just really talented people that were involved in kind of the sort of pixel art scene and the kind of retro chiptune scene as well.
Is that Anamanaguchi or whatever that did the tunes, is it?
Anamanaguchi, the band that made the music. A fellow, Paul Robertson, who did a lot of the animation as well. I remember seeing a lot of his work, kind of it went kind of viral a couple of times. But yeah, his kind of like pixel art videos and that, and he got brought in to do the artwork, which just looks really cool. It's a really unique sort of vibe.
This is one of the first I can think of like the new wave of retro 2D side scrolling beat 'em ups.
Aye.
Do you know how they've got Streets of Rage 4 now, and they're making River City Girls, and they're making all these new ones? This is one of the first that I can remember that took the old graphics, but gave them a touch up, made them look amazing, kept the same kind of gameplay loops, that feel of like an old 2D beat 'em up, and put it on, I think it was Xbox 360, the arcade, live arcade or something.
Yeah,
fucking
that's,
magic.
That's where I played it on.
Any sort of kind of image I seen it, like a video, it looked like it was inspired by Beautiful Joe. You ever played them games?
It's further back than that. As I say, it's taking stuff with Streets of Rage and River City Ransom, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and all that. Very much kind of old arcade beat 'em ups. But because it's, you know, a console game first and foremost, they've kind of geared it around that, where you've got kind of level ups and things, and you're not just, you know, fucking a whole load of lives into it. There is like an actual progression and an actual thing that kind of keeps you coming back to it.
Aye, it's pixel art, but there was unlockable characters and stuff like that, I'm sure, as well. I remember Aaron playing it a lot so that he could unlock Ramona Flowers, who kicked about with a big mallet and stuff like that. It was good fun.
Aye, loads of kind of stuff. Although it came out around the same time as the film, it takes a lot for the comic books as well. Loads of wee kind of little details for the comics and characters and situations that happen and that in it. So if you're a fan of them, which I was at the time, you really kind of get a lot from it. This is a weird one that was kind of like lost media for a while, because it was released digitally on Xbox Live Arcade and then the PlayStation Network. When you lost access to them when console generations moved on, then you pretty much couldn't play it all the way up to 2021, where they've, I guess, managed to wrestle all the rights back and re-release it again, so you can kind of finally play it again, which is good.
That was the kind of good guys winning. There was a lot of fan pressure because this was so good to get it on modern consoles, and they kind of won out in the end.
Yeah.
Aye, nice one. No, that's a good pick. I'll come in and I'll go with my number two, and again, it's well-trodden ground. Going for Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic 2.
Nice.
I think either of the Knights of the Old Republic games could be on my list here, but the second just edges it for me. We've covered this on the podcast before as well, but I think that D&D style role-playing engine with a Star Wars skin over it gives you these worlds that you can just instantly become obsessed in. that whole cinematic style of it. You can just fucking get lost in it. Lose hours and hours of your life. It's the closest to being obsessed with Star Wars as a Wayne you get as an adult, is getting deeply into one of these Knights of the Old Republic games. I go for the second one over the first one, mostly based on the writing. I think you've got more mature writing, a bit of a darker tone, which is typical for these Obsidian sequels to Bethesda games. Again, we've talked about that before, like New Vegas versus Fallout 3, etc. You've heard me wax lyrical probably about KOTOR 2 a million times, but it's just, it had to be on my list.
So what do you think they were trying to do, like, as a sequel? Like, how do you think they tried? How did they improve on the first one? Because I've only played the first one. I never really get around to the second.
They've got a big set of boss on them in this game. Because this is kind of an antithesis to the thesis of Star Wars. A lot of this is about how Jedi Code doesn't make sense. And the main villain in this kind of sees the Jedi and the Sith as basically just the same, like either ends of an extreme. And it gets really philosophical about what the implications of this, you know, omniscient, all-powerful force that binds everything are, and how some people can use it, and how there are these coda around how you should use it, and, you know, are these right? They were written thousands of years ago, and what do they mean? It really gets dug into that, and you kind of come away from it feeling like the Jedi weren't that great. They're better than the Sith, but they were also very flawed in their own way, which is really... Star Wars works as a kid's film, you know what I mean? It's a good versus evil parable. Do you know what I mean?
It's got a lot of politics in it as well, but
when you get into your episode one and stuff like that, but the politics of the original trilogy are
Rebel Alliance trying to beat the Empire.
Yeah.
The Viet Cong are going to beat the Yanks, do you know what I mean? the plucky rebel group are going to beat the evil empire. The good triumphs over evil, that love conquers hate. This gets really philosophical. And there's a deep dive into, I don't know, the whole moral systems involved and stuff like that. It's really fucking good.
You can see why this is a bit of a dicey prospect, because they tried to revisit some of these themes in Star Wars The Last Jedi, and fans reacted violently against it.
Yes, everybody fucking hated it. And he used a lot of Knights of the Old Republic too, and admittedly so. Who wants to come in and who wants to kick off with our number one?
I'll go GoldenEye.
Got to be.
It's an N64. I'm an N64 guy on a podcast. Can't even not go GoldenEye, can I? So, Soft Insighted has been the first kind of AAA multiplayer console shooter. At times where console gaming was still the SNES and the Mega Drive at the time. PC games did have first-person shooters for quite some time. But this game was built on a console that was still considered a toy at the time. That was made for four people to sit in a room and play a fully-fledged 3D first-person shooter.
Aye. Which were the preserves of your fucking... the smelliest of nerds with our LAN parties all connecting their computers together, playing their Dooms and their Quakes and things like that. This was the first time something like that was available to the layperson.
Everybody.
The same gold now is FPS for jocks.
Pretty much.
Well, the thing is... we kind of gave the single player a pasting, right? I know.
Well, I gave it a pasting. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't think it held up that much.
See, I'll go with that, right? It looks archaic, right? But if you look at how they actually built the levels, I was thinking about it kind of after we'd done that, and I kind of felt bad about it. In terms of the level design, you know, at the time, level design in the mid-90s was all about kind of getting a concept and just building, like, things around, like, concepts, like from Back to the Future, and maybe have, like, DeLoreans all flying about and that for no real reason. But in GoldenEye, they're taking existing set pieces for the film, like actual set pieces, and they'll build a level of them by creating objectives, so you can approach your level for any way you want. You can complete your objective in any order you want, in the context of the set piece of the film, you know? Rather than it just being like, oh, right, let's just have, like, fucking... I don't know. Well, there is a lot of Soviet soldiers in it, right? But instead of just having, like, okay, let's have this computer because there's loads of computers in there, the computers are there because you're in a certain part of the film, you know what I mean?
I was frustrated because it was like, oh, go and find this Soviet scientist, but don't kill him, but kill this scientist, blah, blah, doing all these objectives. When I wanted to be running about playing multiplayer, that's what I want to do when I play GoldenEye.
I think you're right, but at the same time, you've got to remember having a Nintendo console, right, at the time, you've just had the SNES. Super Mario's just came out, gave Mario a completely different way to play it, right? And this gave a first-person shooter a kind of sheen as well. Playing a non-linear way of playing a first-person shooter, approaching enemies as you liked. Like, you could either go stealthy, or else you could go all-in whenever you felt appropriate. You also had all them sort of different levels and that had replayability.
Hi, and also, and I'm happy to sign off on this as a podcast, if he's wanting to agree, Pierce Brosnan is the best James Bond.
I'll go with that, aye. And oh, let's just say as well, it was polished to perfection because Rareware at the time were possibly at their fucking peak. And it's hard to slate a Rareware game. Even the models on the faces for the N64, which wasn't very good at textures, still good.
Rareware was the Beatles of the N64. It was hit after hit after hit. Nae shiters.
Conker's Bad Fur Day was one of Ringo's solo albums.
Let's just end on this, right? GoldenEye 007. Let's just say, if it wasn't completely revolutionary in terms of first-person shooters because of it existed in the PC before, what it did was influence and pioneer everything that came after it, on consoles especially.
Aye.
And it set a standard, a craftsmanship, and it set a standard, a polish, that meant that the bar was set going forward for games like Medal of Honor, Call of Duty, Timesplitters, and everything we have today.
Timesplitters 2, probably still my favourite FPS of all time, and it owes everything to GoldenEye.
Yep.
Right. Mick, I'm gonna let you close us out. I'll come in and give you my number one first of all.
Okay.
Blade Runner, 1997. The Blade Runner point and click game, man. Fucking masterpiece. You play as a rookie Blade Runner called Ray McCoy, and it kicks off with you investigating a crime scene where a group of rogue replicants have, like, murdered a load of exotic animals, which in the Blade Runner universe is a really fucking hardcore, heavy-duty crime.
Because they're extinct.
Yeah, basically every animal is extinct. They're on the brink of extinction. So you kill a zebra, there might only be like 4 zebras in the world, man. That's fucking evil. So you're there investigating this crime. That leads on to you tracking down these kind of rogue replicants. So this is a point-and-click adventure game. Rather than your kind of traditional puzzle-solving a la a Monkey Island or something like that, this is a lot more about detective work, searching crime scenes for clues, interviewing cunts for more info and leads, and so on. The brilliance of this game is that there is a random element whereby different characters will be replicants different times that you play it. Oh, and by the way, you get a gay cunt's the Voight Kampff test from the movie. Yeah,
I'm always a fan of a detective type of game, and that's a good twist on it as well, because one of the things that you could say that a lot of the old classic adventure games suffered from was you could always just read a walkthrough and complete it. Whereas with this one, you know, if it's a randomised element, sometimes folk are replicants, sometimes they aren't, you're forced to just use your head, actually be Deckard, be a detective, you know?
Also, this game has a weird real-time engine whereby when you undertake actions in the game, other actors within this world will be out there also undertaking actions. It might be other Blade Runners picking up info about replicants. It might be the replicants themselves committing more crimes and stuff like that. This is also randomised to a degree, so your playthroughs end up fucking wildly different. There are also different endings based on whether you kill replicants or whether you let them go, or I think whether you arrest them as well. There's all sorts of variables, man. This, for something made in 1997, it's magic.
I've not played this one.
Very few people have, and because it's never came out on anything else, you can only really play this on an old PC. It's notoriously difficult to get running on any sort of modern hardware. I managed it after tearing my hair out. I never managed to beat a game, actually. It was on my old computer. This is really hard to get running, but once you do, it's fucking magic. See if they could... I don't actually know... I could have done better research here as to why the Blade Runner game hasn't been brought out on Steam or hasn't come to, like, Xbox or PlayStation or something, because it would be an instant hit. It's so good.
Aye, it's definitely one I fancy checking out for some time as well. So are we talking kind of 3D? Like, is this, like, around maybe the same time as Grim Fandango and that?
Yeah, 3D, that way, aye. It's 3D graphics. It's the graphics, they're no shite. They're standard for the time. I wouldn't say the graphics are why you're playing this. It's getting the gay cunts Voight Kampff tests. Let's be honest. It's being a Blade Runner. Aye. It's being in that fucking Deckard world. Is what
you're... When, you know, these adventure games creatively were kind of on the last legs, you felt like they didn't have a whole lot of ideas left. This one seemed to be doing quite a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, and too few people played it, unfortunately, but it went all in. So many fucking concepts, and is criminally a wee bit forgotten. So yeah, if we're doing a movie tie-in games episode, this has to be my number one. Mick, closes out, what's your number one?
So I'm going to bring in a game that's not just an adaptation of one classic movie, but an adaptation of a load of classic movies, specifically Disney movies. We're talking Aladdin, we're talking Peter Pan, we're talking The Lion King. I am talking about Kingdom Hearts for the PS2.
Oh, aye. I hadn't even thought of this one.
So, I mean, you've probably seen the fucking memes, you've seen all the guff about light and darkness and hearts, Goofy and Donald being, like, really out of place in the world of Final Fantasy characters.
Donald Duck talking about how he wants to fight Sephiroth and that.
Donald Duck fucking hates Sephiroth, man.
He does.
When he's defining characteristics. But when you go back to how this started, a chance conversation in a lift, so the story goes, between like a Square and a Disney executive, and they end up kind of mashing these worlds together, and ended up in a game which is, I mean, kind of buggy, had its issues, but actually had a lot of charm and a lot of thought put into like this weird combination of like Final Fantasy and Disney. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense on paper. Pretty competent like action RPG. Combining the sort of the best of like Final Fantasy PS, like Final Fantasy X sort of era battles with like a real time element as well, where you're kind of jumping around and slashing your big daft looking Keyblade baddies.
I mean, this game is such a fucking cringe concept, right? That it lives or dies based on whether or not the battles are actually really fun. And they must be, because so many people are fans of this, in spite of what you're fucking looking at on the screen, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good wee RPG. Like, I found myself doing a lot of the side quests. I find myself in the Colosseum, during the Hercules world, but that serves as your kind of boss arena, where you're kind of fighting loads of secret enemies and that, and I was unlocking all these weapons. You get different variants of your Keyblade, there's a kind of crafting system to build, and those are quite cool designs, actually. You're quite kind of excited to kind of find unlock new ones just to see how it was designed and how it incorporated themes of like a different Disney cartoon or something like that.
The art styles of these two universes shouldn't work, but they fucking do.
Yeah, I know. It really, as I say, on paper, it makes no sense whatsoever. In later games in the series, you kind of get the impression that like Tetsuya Nomura had a lot of his own ideas, a lot of his own characters. They wanted to bring in kind of anime nonsense type of characters. And the Disney stuff feels like mer and mer. A vestigial. The Disney characters are vestigial. You're like, why is Daffy Duck still here and that? Like, not Daffy Duck, fucking Donald Duck. Why is Donald Duck still here? When you're fighting against the embodiment of the lack of a soul in the world of darkness or whatever the later games are all about. But in this one, they made some effort to kind of gel the Final Fantasy and Disney worlds together. Your main villains are basically like your sort of evil witches for like classic Disney films. You've got like Ursula and the witch face Sleeping Beauty and all that.
Does Pete get a run out?
Yeah, Pete is like a kind of recurring villain. He's kind of like the main kind of. He's the one that they kind of send out to do their dirty work.
Pete's a fireman.
Yeah, Pete's the fireman. He's a kind of recurring boss that you kind of keep showing up and you keep kind of have to fight. And then you go to all these different Disney themed worlds and kind of recreate the plots of various films.
See, that's a concept of bringing like different franchises into like your IP. It's been stolen by like Fortnite, isn't it? Fortnite does that now, it brings everything in.
Aye, Fortnite doesn't really have like a plot so much. It's kind of like a big. It's kind of like just pouring all your toys out on the flare and playing with them all together. That's like the appeal of Fortnite, as I understand it.
Aye.
But this one, it does, you know, it's as mad a concept as it is. It kind of tries to kind of weave a sort of coherent narrative with all these things, and you know, it's bizarre, but yeah, it kind of works, and I found myself enjoying it a lot more than I thought I would. I played the greatest hits version of this game, which was pretty cheap out of game, and I was not sold on the concept at all when it was first announced. I thought, this sounds like a load of nonsense, and then I seen a cutscene in a video online, which is like a secret, super secret ending cutscene you get, and there's all these mad anime characters doing kind of cool battles and stuff like that, and then at the end, Mickey Mouse takes off a black cloak and reveals himself to be Mickey Mouse. It's actually like a kind of secret super ninja warrior, and that's what kind of piqued my interest in the series. I thought, this actually looks quite cool, but as I look back on it, I realise that the actual Disney stuff is probably what you what really made it unique.
Class, superb.
Well, that's a nice wee listicle for yous anyway, listeners. Kingdom Hearts is another one that's long been threatened with a Neddy run out, particularly for myself, I think, being a Final Fantasy guy.
It's going to have to happen.
It's going to have to happen at some point.
Get fucking Emmy Deck installed, it's not that hard. get PS2 games working on the Steam Deck.
I like playing PS2 games on my telly. I've still got a PS2. I've been playing a wee bit of Budokai 3 on it, actually. For next time.
Fair enough, they made like 80 million copies of Kingdom Hearts, you'll be able to find that, no bother.
But aye, there's no games to dish out because we've still got our Akira Toriyama special coming up for yous.
I'm going to spend the rest of the evening playing Legacy of Goku 2, so I'm
about 28 hours into Dragon Quest 6. So hopefully I can actually get that done by the time we record. And McCormick's been playing Budokai 3. As I was talking about there. But aye, all that's left for me to say is up the workers.
Hardcore to the mega.
You've heard the best, now here's the best.
What? Was that best twice?
Let me see that again.
Right, go for it.
Can we just leave it at that? That was quite good.